black migrants, period. And so the only thing that it shows is that the United States, when it sees black migrants, sees detention, and which is unfortunate and just, it's unjust, you know, and a variety of other words that I'm not sure if I can say on this, but
you cannot.
There we go. But what I will say about that is just, again, it's another indication of the hypocrisy that is in U.S. immigration. On Absolutely. One hand, we have you have the United States State Department telling folks, Haitians, that, like, you know, first gen, whatever, that it is unsafe for you to go to Haiti. And yet it continues to deport Haitians or expel Haitians that are seeking refuge in the United States or have been here, whatever it may be, to that same country that they're saying is dangerous and unsafe.
I gotta end you there, Ronald. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so very much. How do people get a hold of Baji or follow Baji if they want to?
For sure. So we are on Twitter, Baji Tweet. You can visit our website where you'll have all of that information at baji.org, baji.org. And then obviously if folks want to reach me, I'm always available by email at ronald@baji.org. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. Appreciate you. Have a great day. We are out of time, folks. I want to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator for today, Gary Baca, and assistant producer, Alicia Vargas. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Community Radio, KBOO.
KBOO's end of the year drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Join the KBOO family today at kboo.fm/give.
Hi, this is Kendall Boyson, professional life and recovery coach, and you're listening to Encouragementology, the practice of instilling hope.
Hi there. Thanks for joining me. On this show, we are looking internally, conjuring up our courage and celebrating our spunk. Because long-term vision takes guts and long-term goals take perseverance and passion. What's standing in your way? For many of us, fear and self-doubt create roadblock after roadblock, pushing our dreams further from our reach. Let's push back. Instead of changing our goals and altering our pursuit, let's remove the obstacles standing in our way. It's time to pursue guts and grit by conquering fear. What is fear, anyhow? An unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger. So one is perceived threat, and one is actual danger. Can we make this distinction right out of the gate? Remember, we're removing obstacles from our life's journey. To do that effectively, we need to be specific. What if you were afraid of everything? Imagine how that would limit your day, petrified from fear. So let's go ahead and release unnecessary fear, perceived fear. More to come on that. I would like to think that I'm pretty fearless. Let me clarify and quantify that statement just a bit using perceived and actual. I don't like high places where I could fall to my death. Not once has bungee jumping, parachuting, or deep sea diving ever crossed my mind as an enjoyable pastime option. I'm not a fan of snakes, bull riding, or wrestling alligators, and cage or no cage, I will not be swimming with sharks. So maybe I should say I'm quite fearless when it comes to perceived danger. I actually enjoy speaking to large crowds. I'm not shy or reserved, and I believe everyone will like me. Not to sound arrogant in any way. I liken it to a chameleon changing its colors to blend in as a way of protection. You see, by believing everyone will like me, I remove any fear of not being accepted. myself and my ideas. This gives me the confidence to approach anything, from a person to a new idea. It's easy for me to go for it because I believe in what I'm doing and I'm confident that it will be well received. Sometimes after the fact, I chuckle to myself and think, wow, Kendall, that was gutsy. How did you do that? But I'm thankful. Being trapped by fear means you short-side yourself from reaching your true potential. Theodore Roosevelt said, "It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of a high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory or defeat." Tim Newman gets this exploration started with Dissecting Terror, How Does Fear Work?, featured at medicalnewstoday.com. Let's investigate the biology of fear, why it has evolved, what happens in our bodies when we're scared, and why it sometimes gets out of control. What happens in the brain and body when we're scared? Everyone gets scared. Fear is an unavoidable facet of human experience. People generally consider fear an unpleasant emotion, but some go out of their way to trigger it. For example, jumping out of planes or watching a scary movie. Fear is justifiable. For instance, hearing footsteps inside your house when you know that you're the only one home is a valid reason to be terrified. Fear can also be inappropriate. For example, we might experience a rush of terror while watching a slasher movie, even though we know that the monster is an actor in makeup and that the blood is not real. Many individuals consider phobias to be the most inappropriate manifestation of fear. These can attach themselves to pretty much anything: spiders, clowns, paper, or carpets, and significantly impact people's lives. So why do we get scared? As far as evolution is concerned, fear is ancient, and to a certain extent, we can thank fear for our success as a species. Any creature that doesn't run and hide from bigger animals or dangerous situations is likely to be removed from the gene pool before it gets a chance to procreate. Fear's essential role in survival helps explain why it sometimes seems a little trigger happy. In other words, it makes sense to be a little jumpy if you're an animal in a hostile environment. It's better to run and hide when your own shadow catches you by surprise than to presume that a shadow is safe, only to be eaten by a bear 5 seconds later. People often refer to the physiological changes that occur when a person experiences fear as the fight or flight response. Overall, as the name suggests, the changes prepare the animal to either fight or run. Breathing rate increases, heart rate follows suit. Peripheral blood vessels in the skin, for instance, constrict. Central blood vessels around vital organs dilate to flood them with oxygen and nutrients, and muscles are pumped with blood ready to react. Well, in the face of real danger, I've always been afraid that I would be paralyzed by fear. I mean, how do you really know what you would do unless you were actually in a terrifying situation? You can visualize yourself street fighting with a perpetrator, but is that really how it would go down? Instead of worrying about my reaction, creating undue anxiety, I let the feeling go. Sounds heavenly, right? No, really. I choose not to react to situations that may or may not ever happen. It's counterproductive. Does that mean my heart never races and I walk through life cool as a cucumber? No. It simply means that I am making a choice to release fear, worry, and anxiety. I will not let them take root in my mind. They are not welcome here. You are in charge of your brain. Say it. I am in charge of my brain. No longer will I let it play tricks on me, worry without cause, and stress without reason. I will leave it open and ready to problem solve when needed, daydream, wonder, and rest. Over at nm.org, I found 5 things you never knew about fear. Fear is physical. Fear is experienced in your mind, but it triggers a strong physical reaction in your body. The amygdala alerts your nervous system, which sets your body's fear response into motion. Stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline are released. Your blood pressure and your heart rate increase. You start breathing faster. Even your blood flow changes. Blood actually flows away from your heart and into your limbs, making it easier for you to start throwing punches or run for your life. Your body is preparing for fight or flight. Fear can make you foggy. As some parts of your brain are revving up, others are shutting down. When the amygdala senses fear, the cerebral cortex, area of the brain that harnesses reason and judgment, becomes impaired. So now it's difficult to make good decisions or think clearly. As a result, you might scream and throw up your hands when approached by an actor in a haunted house, unable to rationalize that the threat is not real. Fear can become pleasure. But why do people who love roller coasters, haunted houses, and horror movies enjoy getting caught up in those fearful, stressful moments? Because the thrill doesn't necessarily end when the ride or the movie ends. Through the excitation transfer process, your body and brain remain aroused even after your scary experience is over. Dr. Sikora says, during a staged fear experience, your brain will produce more of a chemical called dopamine, which elicits pleasure. Fear is not a phobia. If you're slightly uneasy about swimming in the ocean after watching Jaws, the movie did what it was set out to do. But if you find yourself terrorized, traumatized, and unable to function at the mere thought of basking on the beach, you might be experiencing more than just fear. The difference between fear and phobia is simple. Fears are common reactions to events or objects. But a fear becomes a phobia when it interferes with your ability to function and maintain a consistent quality of life. If you start taking extreme measures to avoid water, spiders, or people, you might have a phobia. Fear keeps you safe. Fear is a natural and biological condition that we all experience. It's important that we experience fear because it keeps us safe. Fear is a complex human emotion that can be positive and healthy, but it can also have a negative consequence. If a fear or phobia affects your life in negative and inconvenient ways, speak to your primary care provider, who can help you determine the kind of treatment you might need. Okay, I am sorry. Who saw the movie and had zero fears of the ocean? Unlike Friday the 13th, where I'm pretty sure Michael Myers is fictional, sharks are real. At any rate, some fears are not necessary to overcome. I do just as well sunning on the sand, appreciating the ocean from afar. Conquering fears that have you trapped or prevent you from moving forward and experiencing your true potential, well, that's another thing. Getting to the root of that fear, unpacking the real versus perceived, then facing what you can is important. Josh Stimmel gives us some ideas with 14 ways to conquer fear found at Forbes.com. Number 1, understand fear and embrace it. Fear exists to keep us safe. It's not inherently bad or good, but a tool we can use to make better decisions. Fear isn't designed to keep us inactive, but to help us act in ways that generate the results we need and want. Embrace fear as instruction and let it inform your actions, but not control them. Number two, don't just do something, stand there. We tend to admire people who are quick to action, but being deliberate, creating a plan, and pacing yourself are also actions. Many a successful undertaking has been threatened or ruined by haste alone. When fear strikes, consider whether the correct action might be to analyze the options and make a wise, well-thought-out choice rather than jumping to what it might seem the heat of the moment. Number three, name the fear. Sometimes merely stating what your fear is gives you the strength to deal with it. Say your fear out loud, write it down, or focus your mind on it. When you try to ignore your fear, it grows. When you face it, it shrinks. Number four, think long-term. If you're an entrepreneur, you may be afraid you won't make the next payroll, but what's your three-month outlook or the outlook for 3 years from now? Thinking about the long-term won't fix your short-term problem, but it can help you think about it more objectively and come up with the right solution. Number five, educate yourself. We are afraid of nothing so much as the unknown. If your fear is based on a lack of information, then get the information or knowledge you need to examine the situation based on facts rather than speculation. Number six, prepare, practice, role play. The long-standing top fear in the United States is public speaking. In many surveys, death itself ranks into second place to standing in front of a group and opening your mouth. If your fear is related to your performance in a certain activity, then prepare, practice, and role play. Carmine Gallo, the author of Talk Like TED, talks about Dr. Jill Bolt Taylor, who practiced her popular TED Talk, which now has over 18 million views and counting. She practiced it more than 200 times. If you don't have that much time, Gallo says, I find that practicing a presentation a minimum of 10 times is ideal. Number seven, utilize peer pressure. Have you ever done something scary like jumping off a high bridge into a river below only because your friends who were there were egging you on? Peer pressure, like fear itself, can be positive or negative depending on how it's wielded. Surround yourself with people who will push you to overcome your fears that are holding you back from what you want. Number eight, visualize success. Athletes may imagine the successful completion of a physical task thousands of times before achieving it. This mental mapping ensures that when the body moves, it's more likely to follow its preordained path. The same practice will prepare you to succeed at whatever you're trying to achieve. Number nine, gain a sense of proportion. How big of a deal really is the thing you're afraid of? We sometimes get so caught up in the success or failure of a particular quest that we lose sense of where it fits in with everything else we value. Ask yourself, what's the worst that can happen? Sometimes the reality is bad, but often you might find that the fear itself is worse than whatever it is you're afraid of happening. Number 10, get help. Whatever you're afraid of, is it something that you have to do it alone? Can you find a mentor or support group to help you through it? Athletes have coaches, students have teachers. Sometimes friends, even if they have no experience or expertise in what you're struggling with, can provide the needed support to face your fear. Number 11, follow others, find a recipe. Are you doing something that has never been done? Or can you follow the footsteps of someone else who has accomplished it before? Is there a formula for success? Has someone written a book on the topic? Or can you tweak a formula from another field to meet your needs? Number 12, have a positive attitude. In the Brian Tracy's book, The Power of Self-Confidence, become unstoppable, irresistible, and unafraid in every area of your life. He asks, what would you do differently if you were absolutely guaranteed of success in any undertaking? Would you try more things? Would you keep working long after others had given up? People who have positive attitudes are successful because they keep trying after others give up. Number 13, be willing to pivot. As the adage goes, if at first you don't succeed, try again. But there's also the saying, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. If you're afraid to do something again because it didn't work out the last time, figure out why it didn't work and try something different before you give up altogether. Number 14, focus on others as your motivation. There are things we would never do for ourselves that we would quickly and fearlessly do for others. Hiram Smith, the co-founder of Franklin Covey, once asked a mother in his audience during a presentation if she would be willing to cross a standard metal, like an I-beam, placed on the roof of a skyscraper to another. She said no, she wouldn't. He asked her if she would do it for $1 million and added that now there was a bit of wind and some raindrops falling. She still wouldn't. Then he told her to imagine he was holding her child over the edge of the opposite building, and if she wasn't there in 10 seconds, he would drop the child. What do you think her answer was under those circumstances? My motivator is winning. Not beating everyone else, but challenging myself to growth and winning. I love setting goals, visualizing what it will take to reach those goals, creating action plans, and then executing. I'm energized when I see an idea start in my mind, get transferred to paper, shared with Matt, and then start to take form. Wow, there is nothing like it. So what happens when it doesn't work out? Devastating blow? Maybe for a hot minute, then I move into problem-solving mode. My desire hasn't changed, but it's clear my approach has to if I want to see this through. When do you give in, and when do you give up? James Clear gives us Grit, a complete guide on being mentally tough found at jamesclear.com. Step 1. Define what grit or mental toughness means for you. For you, it might be going 1 month without missing a workout, delivering your work ahead of schedule for 2 days in a row, calling one friend to catch up every Saturday this month. Whatever it is, be clear about what you're going after. Step 2, build grit with some physical wins. So often we think that grit is about how we respond to extreme situations, but what about everyday circumstances? Mental toughness is like a muscle. It needs to be worked to grow and develop. Choose to do the 10th rep when it would be easier to do just 9. Choose to create when it would be easier to consume. Choose to ask the extra question when it would be easier to accept. Prove to yourself in 1,000 tiny ways that you have enough guts to get in the ring and do battle with life. Step 3, build strong habits and stop depending on motivation. Grit isn't about getting an incredible dose of inspiration or courage. It's about building the daily habits that allow you to stick to a schedule and overcome challenges and distractions over and over and over again. Mentally tough people don't have to be more courageous, more talented, or more intelligent, just more consistent. Grit comes down to your habits. It's about doing the things you know you're supposed to do on a more consistent basis. It's about your dedication to daily practice and your ability to stick to a schedule. You might be grittier and gutsier than you first realized. Have these ideas brought to mind some goals you've been unwilling to let go of? Dreams that you're still working towards even though it's taken longer than expected? Ideas can be quick, but executing those ideas and seeing real success can be a lengthy endeavor. Find an accountability partner, not just to hold you accountable, but someone who can offer encouragement through the rough patches, help you get past the failures and overcome any naysayers. Someone who you trust and who you can also share with. It can be fun to help each other shape and mold your dreams. This is a short TED Talk by psychology professor Angela Duckworth. She's explaining the concept of grit and how it helps foster mental toughness in our everyday lives.
When I was 27 years old, I left a very demanding job in management consulting for a job that was even more demanding, teaching. I went to teach seventh graders math in the New York City public schools. And like any teacher, I made quizzes and tests. I gave out homework assignments. When the work came back, I calculated grades. What struck me was that IQ was not the only difference between my best and my worst students. Some of my strongest performers did not have stratospheric IQ scores. Some of my smartest kids weren't doing so well. And that got me thinking. The kinds of things you need to learn in seventh grade math, sure, they're hard. Ratios, decimals, the area of a parallelogram. But these concepts are not impossible. And I was firmly convinced that every one of my students could learn the material if they worked hard and long enough. After several more years of teaching, I came to the conclusion that what we need in education is a much better understanding of students and learning from a motivational perspective, from a psychological perspective. In education, the one thing we know how to measure best is IQ. But what if doing well in school and in life depends on much more than your ability to learn quickly and easily? So I left the classroom and I went to graduate school to become a psychologist. I started studying kids and adults in all kinds of super challenging settings. And in every study, my question was, who is successful here and why? My research team and I went to West Point Military Academy. We tried to predict which cadets would stay in military training and which would drop out. We went to the National Spelling Bee and tried to predict which children would advance farthest in competition. We studied rookie teachers working in really tough neighborhoods, asking which teachers are still going to be here in teaching by the end of the school year. And of those, who will be the most effective at improving learning outcomes for their students? We partnered with private companies, asking which of these salespeople is going to keep their jobs and who's going to earn the most money. In all those very different contexts, one characteristic emerged as a significant predictor of success. And it wasn't social intelligence, it wasn't good looks, physical health, and it wasn't IQ. It was grit. Grit is passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. Grit is having stamina. Grit is sticking with your future, day in, day out, not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years, and working really hard to make that future a reality. Grit is living life like it's a marathon, not a sprint. A few years ago, I started studying grit in the Chicago public schools. I asked thousands of high school juniors to take grit questionnaires, and then waited around more than a year to see who would graduate. Turns out that grittier kids were significantly more likely to graduate, even when I matched them on every characteristic I could measure, things like family income, standardized achievement test scores, even how safe kids felt when they were at school. So it's not just at West Point or the National Spelling Bee that grit matters, it's also in school, especially for kids at risk for dropping out. To me, the most shocking thing about grit is how little we know, how little science knows about building it. Every day, parents and teachers ask me, how do I build grit in kids? What do I do to teach kids a solid work ethic? How do I keep them motivated for the long run? The honest answer is, I don't know. What I do know is that talent doesn't make you gritty. Our data show very clearly that there are many talented individuals who simply do not follow through on their commitments. In fact, in our data, grit is usually unrelated or even inversely related to measures of talent. So far, the best idea I've heard about building grit in kids is something called growth mindset. This is an idea developed at Stanford University by Carol Dweck, and it is the belief that the ability to learn is not fixed, that it can change with your effort. Dr. Dweck has shown that when kids read and learn about the brain and how it changes and grows in response to challenge, they're much more likely to persevere when they fail because they don't believe that failure is a permanent condition. So growth mindset is a great idea for building grit, but we need more. And that's where I'm going to end my remarks, because that's where we are. That's the work that stands before us. We need to take our best ideas, our strongest intuitions, and we need to test them. We need to measure whether we've been successful, and we have to be willing to fail, to be wrong, to start over again with lessons learned. In other words, we need to be gritty about getting our kids grittier. Thank you.
If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they are not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, evaluate perceived from actual when exploring your fears. Choose to release irrational fear, avoiding reactions to perceived threats. Instead, explore your goals, conjuring guts and grit as you make a commitment for the long haul. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Hi, this is Kendall Boyson, professional life and recovery coach, and you're listening to Encouragementology, the practice of instilling hope. Hi there. Thanks for joining me. On this show, we're going to slow our mad dash to get somewhere and celebrate where we are. As you look back over this year, take stock of all you've done, all you've experienced, how you've grown, and where you've added value. So much of our time and energy is invested in setting goals and striving to hit those goals. What do we do when we get there? We make new goals. Very little time is spent on celebrating the win. What happens when we don't reach the goal? We give up most of the time, but sometimes we re-engineer that goal and try again. But very little time, if any, is spent on celebrating what we did accomplish and the growth and learning we received as a result. The quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson might sound cliche. Destination, it's the journey. But it's true. Even though it's more about the climb, the celebration gives you that much-needed intrinsic reward to motivate you as you journey to the next destination. So as you look back over your year, what stands out? Are you able to immediately pinpoint the positive highlights, or are your wins overshadowed by your losses? Isn't it frustrating the way our brain gives priority to challenges and threats versus positive outcomes? Put a pin in that and we'll come back to it. Were you able to check off things on your to-do list and complete some desired goals? What did you do to celebrate or reward yourself? Who in your inner circle was invited? Did you keep it to yourself or overpost on social media? It's okay, we can be honest here. Let's trace the steps of this year's journey to get a push where we might be stuck and to give kudos where we might have overlooked an accomplished milestone. Let's also find some healthy habits we can adopt to make the climb that much more rewarding. As the title explains, let's start with the celebration. Whitney Johnson helps us kick off the party with Celebrate to Win, found at Harvard Business Review. As adults, we're often much better at work than play. In fact, we seem to turn play into a form of work, one at which we are sadly less competent. Take, for example, office retirement and birthday parties, complete with balloons, pastries, and the requisite crudité platter. It's usually a drop-by between meetings party. Say hi, grab a plate of goodies to eat alone at your desk. Even the guest of honor may only do a flyby. Most of us don't have a good plan to celebrate accomplishments, and the lack of celebration has only become more pronounced and consequential after 2 years of isolation. This is unfortunate because celebration is an important opportunity to cement the lessons learned on the path to achievement and to strengthen the relationships between people that make future achievement more plausible. When we speak of celebration, we don't mean inebriated partying, but rather commemorative events that encompass complex emotions, including solemnity and poignancy, as well as pleasure and joy in the journey. Every initiative or growth journey we undertake, whether personal or professional, can be modeled by an S-curve of learning. At the base of the S, we are on launch point, where we encounter fruitful struggle. Resources and expertise may be in short supply. Growth is slow, sometimes hard to discern, but it's happening. Small, achievable goals and appropriate metrics help us see momentum and experience early victories. As expertise and momentum build, we tip into a sweet spot of competence, a phase of rapidly accelerating progress and productivity. Many projects may come to successful completion during this time. Eventually, however, our growth slows as we approach mastery. The top of the S can be a danger zone of boredom and stagnation. It's time for a new challenge. Eventually, we do have to move on to a new challenge, but it's important to remember that celebration is itself an important milestone on the S curve, where it's an individual's, a team's, or an entire organization's S curve. Most organizations don't seem to have a celebration strategy, and individuals also have an on-to-the-next mindset, as though it's contrary to productivity and efficiency to relish, even briefly. Nothing could be further from the truth. Fortunately, it's easy to integrate celebration into your life and organization. Here are some strategies to start with. Celebrate early and small. Progress is hard won early in a challenge, the launch point on the S-curve. It can be discouraging and require painful perseverance. So why wouldn't we celebrate the early victories, no matter how small? Leading behavioral scientist BJ Fogg explains the link between emotions and habits. Habit formation is not, as conventional wisdom claims, a matter of 21 days of consistent practice. Celebrating small wins stimulate dopamine release in the brain, a feel-good chemical that reinforces the learning experience and strengthens our sense of connection to those we work with. Change and growth are promoted through positive emotions more than through disciplined practice. Keep in mind that celebration is an experience, and in the workplace, it's more effective when shared with colleagues. It's not a certificate, a gift card, or an Employee of the Month parking spot, although those rewards may serve a purpose too. Just as the accomplishments we celebrate don't have to be large, our celebrations don't have to be grandiose. They just need to be meaningful. Cancer patients completing a course of chemotherapy are encouraged to ring the bell while being applauded by individual caregivers. This psychologically powerful acknowledgement, though small, should never be skipped. Celebrate in the interim. The sweet spot of the S-curve is the phase of greatest productivity. As an individual or leader, there are good reasons to want to extend this stretch of the curve for as long as reasonably possible. This can require reconfigured teams, stretch projects, and imposed constraints to keep the challenge level high enough to prolong growth and engagement. These techniques ensure that many smaller mountains will be scaled en route to the ultimate summit. Celebrate all of them. We don't just celebrate our first birthday or our last. We celebrate every birthday in between. Whenever an objective is achieved, have a plan to commemorate it, even if the actual objective and commemoration are modest. Make sure individuals recognize their own achievements and know that their managers and teams recognize and appreciate them too. Celebration reinforces lessons learned, practices adopted, and strengthens the foundation and esprit de corps for future accomplishment. Celebrate at the top. This seems obvious, but apparently it isn't. For example, consider the typical retirement celebration. Even for the big ultimate events, we struggle to hit pause on our busyness to try to acknowledge the mountain we conquered. Fred B. Bryant describes celebrating his victory atop Snowmass Mountain in Colorado in Savoring a New Model of Positive Experience, which was co-authored by the late Joseph Viroff. Bryant had attempted to climb twice previously without success. He knew it was unlikely he would ever return. So he lingered with his friends, taking in the spectacular view and committing the sensations of the moment to memory. The smell of the air, the sound of the wind, the details of the scenery. He mentally reviewed the challenges he had overcome to reach this moment. Then he embraced his friends, his climbing colleagues, and expressed his gratitude to have shared the climb and the celebratory moment with them. In all, he spent about 10 minutes at the summit basking in the joy and poignancy of the moment of mastery. Your mountain might be landing a dream job, a product launch, closing the deal with a big client, going public, or one of many common but uncommon for you events. The celebration need not be long or elaborate, but it must be meaningful. Celebrate the day. Each day is an S-curve of its own. I encourage you to think of them this way. Take a few moments in the morning before engaging in tasks, even before reading email, to think through your day to come. What is the most important objective to achieve today? This is the mountaintop, the summit of the day's S-curve. Whatever else the day requires, keep this critical objective the top priority. The morning contemplation is your base camp from which to attack the climb. At the end of the day, celebrate achievement or your progress towards it. BJ Fogg says celebration can be as simple as looking in the mirror and claiming victory. Celebration is an event, not a destination. It's the little pause where we survey the road we've traveled and the mountain we've climbed. We can have a snack with our colleagues or friends rather than alone in our office. We rest, we catch our breath, we contemplate the next opportunity ahead before descending to climb again. But the fact that the interval is brief doesn't make it unimportant or harmless if neglected. Celebrating achievements, great and small, is high-octane fuel for future achievement. We don't celebrate the win, we celebrate to win. I can remember being so hard on myself. I'm pretty goal-driven, and early on, I thought there was only one way to get there, and if that didn't work, then it wasn't meant to be. Throw in the towel and move on. Then I discovered this idea of re-engineering. Maybe it wasn't the goal or the process, but maybe the approach. Or the approach was right, but the process was off. Oh, and I discovered a little thing called timing and how that ultimately impacts everything. Isn't it funny that you can't figure out these things when you're in the throes of it? Hindsight, right? But that's why learning from your failed attempts is so very valuable. Imagine if the Roomba stopped when it hit its first wall. Oy, you would have taken that thing back day one. Let's try to remember that learning is a process and it's not always fun in the moment. And a failure shouldn't overshadow all the successes before you hit the snag. Blake Thorne explains why your brain has a negativity bias and how to fix it, found at I Done This, The Science of Small Wins. Pretend you're a caveman. You're in your cave preparing for your hunt, but something outside seems dangerous. You hear violent sounds you don't understand. You have two choices: skip the hunt, spend the night hungry, but live another day, or risk death and go outside. Hold on to that thought. We'll be getting back to it. Now imagine you're driving to work. While getting off the highway, someone cuts you off. You slam on your brakes. You know the feeling that's coming. A tense anger rises up. Your fingers clutch the steering wheel. It's enough to make you feel horrible all day. You might be less productive at work and distracted during meetings. You might try to counterbalance that feeling with a quick shot of endorphins from junk food, mindless web surfing, or time wasting. This only compounds the problem. This is like taking short-term unhappiness and investing it in a long-term, high-yield unhappiness investment plan, ensuring belly flab and career stagnation for years to come. So why does this one minor thing, getting cut off, have such a powerful effect on us? Why does one negative experience ruin our otherwise great day? The answer has to do with our friend, the caveman. Research shows that our brains evolved to react much more strongly to negative experiences than positive ones. It keeps us safe from danger. But in modern days, where physical danger is minimal, it often gets in the way. It's called the negativity bias. It isn't entirely the caveman's fault. The neurological roots of the negativity bias, first identified by psychologists Paul Rosen and Ed Rosenman in 2001, started long before that. In Dr. Rick Hansen's book on this topic, Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence, he writes that humans share ancestors with bats, begonias, and bacteria that go back at least 3.5 billion years. Hansen describes these ancestors as living in a world of carrots and sticks. Carrots are rewards, food, sex, and shelter, and sticks are punishments, like predators, disease, and injury. Over hundreds of millions of years, it was a matter of life and death to pay extra attention to sticks. React to them intensely, remember them well, and over time become even more sensitive to them. Carrots and sticks are internal as well as external. It was found that bad experiences are almost always stronger than good, and the way we take in that information shapes how we see ourselves. Bad emotions, bad parents, and bad feedback have more impact than good ones. The self is more motivated to avoid bad self-definitions than to pursue good ones. The negativity bias is so powerful, we might do anything to avoid the stick rather than to find a way to pursue the carrot. In other words, the caveman is both scared of the predator and the threat of failing, potentially causing him to hide in a cave and never find a way to successfully hunt. Our focus on negative things is rooted in how our attention works. Arian Mack and Irvin Rock are psychologists who pioneered the concept of inattentional blindness. Before their research, it was natural to assume that your sensory organs, like your eyes, ears, etc., consumed all the information available to them at any given time.
These organs pipe that information to your brain, and your brain made decisions based on it. The framing might be positive or negative, but we assume the brain at least had the data it needed to make the informed decision. That's not entirely true. It turns out Mack and Rock revealed that there's a fundamental difference between perception and awareness. In their research, the psychologists asked participants to identify normally identifiable things like faces and names. Mack and Rock found that if they made these things less identifiable, the study participants were less likely to become aware of them. A scrambled face or a misspelled name was harder to even see. A negative bias, then, is really a negative attention bias. When we focus on negative things, we actually reshape our perception into seeing negative things. Not only does negative stimuli trigger more neural activity, but research shows negativity is detected more quickly and easily. The amygdala, the brain region that regulates emotion and motivation, uses about 2/3 of its neurons to detect bad news. Think about this. 2/3 of your motivation regulator is designed to focus on negativity. That seems problematic. Also, economic studies have shown people are more likely to make financial and career decisions based on not achieving something good, but on avoiding something bad. You might assume the best way to beat one bias is with another, fighting fire with fire. Wouldn't your well-being be better served by feeding it positive feelings and information than negative? It's not that easy. Like it or not, evolution hardwired your negativity bias for a reason. Overemphasizing negative events enabled our ancestors to survive. The caveman might live a more anxious life, hiding in a cave and worrying every sound outside is a predator, but that caveman will live longer than the one that assumes every noise means nothing. The optimist might be right 9 times out of 10, but if they're wrong, they're dead. Of course, in modern times, that 1 time out of 10 isn't nearly as deadly, but that doesn't mean the logic is fundamentally flawed. Negative events have the potential to damage you much more than positive events have the potential to help you. Encouraging a positive bias, however, makes it no less likely that you'll avoid negative events or experience positive emotions. In fact, it might do just the opposite. A positive bias is similar to the more well-known term confirmation bias. When you're biased toward positive confirmation, you're much less likely to notice or take in negative information. You set out each day with an expectation and expect the world to conform to it. If it doesn't, you'll find a way to perceive that it does anyway. Your mood might be higher, but so are the risks you're unknowingly inviting. Think of gamblers. Gamblers are very optimistic. They can empty their wallets pursuing a positive event they're absolutely sure is coming. When they're wrong 12 times in a row, a positive bias will reframe this to, "Oh, that means my lucky chance is coming up next." Thankfully, there are things we can do to minimize the negative bias. We won't erase it. It took 3.5 billion years to develop. So it's going to stick around for a little while longer. But there are specific steps we can take to fight back. And research even shows we can physically change our brain to minimize the negative bias. So here are a few exercises that can help. Number one, reframe the language behind your goals. Even Pixar Animation Studios has felt the effects of negativity bias. Company leaders began to notice that employees were hesitant to share honest opinions in meetings. People were afraid of hurting someone else's feelings, afraid of having their own feelings. So leadership introduced a new word, candor. Pixar drives its teams to embrace candor through the Pixar Brain Trust, a small group of well-respected creative leaders in the company's overall film development process. The Brain Trust strives to demonstrate candor by stressing that the film, not the filmmaker, is under the microscope. By establishing this distinction early and often, creative workers are less likely to take feedback personally. And the word candor in the Pixar's hallways became associated with analyzing projects, not people. It worked. Candor, as Catmull put it, freed Pixar's teams from honesty's baggage. This also helps workers buy into the process early on, ensuring creativity momentum instead of negativity bias quicksand. You can support your reframed language with new benefits. If you're running a sales team, for instance, traditional metrics can encourage short-term tactics and burnout. To encourage healthier, more positive behavior, use metrics that encourage that mind shift. If you want candor or positivity, make it a measurable goal that you can pursue. Number two, be aware of the negativity bias. Hansen suggests being mindful of the negativity bias and recognizing that your brain wants to cling to these events like your life depends on it. It's up to you to decide how dangerous, if at all, these experiences really are. That's the negativity bias of the brain. So be aware when you feel yourself drawn to negativity. Tell yourself you're smarter than your brain thinks you are. Develop a mantra. Try this: I'm not a caveman, and this is not a tiger. Repeat it in your head a few times. And now that you know the immense power of negativity, you'll be less likely to invite it into your environment. Number three, keep a gratitude journal. I can hear what you're thinking already. A gratitude journal sounds hokey, cheesy, or silly, but research shows it's much more than that. NPR reports on numerous studies that show practicing gratitude can have all sorts of positive effects. Regularly being thankful and noting the good things in your life can improve sleep, reduce stress, and provide a boost for your relationships. Practicing gratitude is one of the most useful results of research in the field of positive psychology. As cynical as your instincts might be, quantifying the positivity in your life, writing those things down physically, and making it a habit to do so again and again can slowly retrain your mind to focus away from the negativity bias. The more you deliberately think about positive information, the more you can retrain your attention to see that information in real time. Robert Emmons, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis, and a leading expert in positive psychology, has offered several tips on keeping a gratitude journal that include focus on people rather than things. Savor surprise events. Write only once or twice per week, but write with depth. Number four, distract yourself. Do you ever notice how working on a challenging problem can make you forget any minor aches and pains? It turns out we may be able to shake off negative emotions by diverting our mental energy elsewhere, like on a puzzle or a memory game. Distractions can refocus your attention from negative events that might be having a disproportionate effect on your ability to process information. A reprimand at work, for instance, while bad, might cause you to think of your work in a negative light for weeks. Instead of stewing on that fact, turn to a distraction. If you can separate yourself from the negative event, even momentarily, you can put space between you and its power over you. This space gives you perspective. Distraction is a powerful tool and can even be used to help treat symptoms of PTSD. The key, however, is to not use distractions to escape negativity. Negative events are a natural part of life. Running away from them with mindless distractions will only make things worse. But a healthy approach to distractions can give you the space you need to think clearly and be more productive. Number five, Hansen also suggests taking in the good by spending more time soaking in positive experiences, even small ones. Most of the time, a good experience is pretty mild, and that's fine. But try to stay with it for 20 or 30 seconds in a row, instead of getting distracted by something else. By doing this, you're reinforcing positive patterns in your brain. And your brain learns from experiences, building new neural pathways. Researchers call this neuroplasticity. The key here is to give yourself time to let those thoughts settle in. Don't just push them aside. What you're ultimately seeking to do is reshape your brain to allow in more positive information. This change is physical as well as mental, and those physical changes take time. Repeated and sustained patterns of neuromental activation co-occurring together leave lasting physical changes behind in neural structure and function. The negativity bias is powerful, and fighting it will take time, but it's well worth the effort. Practice these things consistently, and you'll notice your negativity bias shrinking. You just have to work for it. You know how misery loves company, right? So does negative self-talk. Before you know it, you've spiraled out of control. Time to pump the brakes and start small. Think about a bouquet of positivity. Start your day collecting all the little moments as you would if you were picking wildflowers. Even if it's the smallest size of a tiny violet, pick it up. Think about the accumulation of flowers throughout the day as you build your bouquet. One by one, notice the positive. Seek it out as you would a four-leaf clover. At the end of your day, mentally review your flowers and remind yourself of all the moments you have to celebrate. This is a great way to combat the negative gray washing that challenges try and paint your day with. Counting your blessings is a habit, and you